ticking time bomb of tension which could explode into a conflict.
We were walking right on the edge. We were walking right on the edge.
This world would be a pretty easy and fun place to live if everybody just minded his own business.
We were walking right on the edge. We were walking right on the edge.
Another explosion. Possibly a bomb being dropped.
Defuse the ticking time bomb of tension.
Get us into the boss, they scream without a throat, without a gun.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Inside Track, episode number 27. If this is the first time you've listened to the show, me and my co-host, Jason Kennedy, who is residing in Taiwan, basically go through this week's review of major political events, which this week has been quite a few. If you'd like to contact the show, we have a website. It's bookarmor.com. And also, we can be contactable through Twitter at InsideTrackDJ. So welcome one and all to the show. Hello, Jay. How you doing, man?
Hi, Dave. Hello.
Are you in good spirits?
Reasonable spirits. We'll talk about my last couple of weeks in Taiwan in a moment, I suppose.
All right, okay. Well, I mean, we can get straight into it now, if you like. As introductions are made, people can contact us. They know where we are. So, how's your week been, NJ? It's been eventful, I hear.
The last 2 weeks have been two of the worst weeks ever. Not due to living in Taiwan. Taiwan is still, you know, a good place to live. But on a on the personal front, it's not been so good. Inside Track, we were recording podcasts instead of going out live as we are today, so I'm very happy to be back live now.
Yeah, definitely.
And I wasn't feeling too alive the last 2 weeks, so what happened very briefly is, firstly, health problems. Firstly, I was struck down with terrible food poisoning, so that wasn't very good. And then the mother of all problems began after I'd recovered from my food poisoning, when I very foolishly ate bacon and egg sandwich, which sort of propelled me into the next universe of pain, and I was hospitalized for a few days after this, and my adventures in the Taiwan healthcare system not very satisfactory by the end, so I kind of ran away from my hospital bed, sick as I was, and just decided to come home and just face the consequences just here with the wife looking after me rather than these sort of nurses who'd had their heads turned. I don't know how familiar you are with the Taiwan healthcare system.
From what I understand, isn't it based on the Canadian health system?
Well, that is, partly. What happened was when they I used to study at a medical university here, so I met some of the architects of the Taiwanese system. What they did was very, very logical. They went out all around the world and surveyed the top healthcare systems in various countries. And as you just said, they did model themselves quite a bit on the Canadian system, but they also looked at the NHS, various other systems, and then they tweaked it for the, you know, the local culture here. So I've got many good things to say about it. One thing that is true is 3 days in hospital, all kinds of tests, all kinds of prescriptions only cost me about £100. UK pounds. Each night in the hospital cost about £30, sharing a room with someone else. So not really that bad, actually. But it's the surgery side here that is so messed up. And as my problem might have required surgery, I had to get into this just awful situation with the surgeon that had appointed himself to oversee my case. So this is where it falls apart, because the surgeons operate as kinds of almost like prostitutes, actually.
Oh, dear.
You know, they were... Oh, sorry.
No, I was going to say, that don't sound too good.
Yeah, well, I was lying in the observation room when this one surgeon sidled up to me and my wife and began his diagnosis/sales pitch. While he was speaking to the wife, he had these doctor's coat on, but the pockets are kind of translucent. And I could see that his hand was on the consent form for his procedure that he was pitching all the way through the conversation. But, you know, he was kind of waiting for the moment to whip it out and have a sign. But he sort of read the runes and decided that he didn't quite reach that point. So he just sort of wandered off on his way. But then this other surgeon sort of came on the scene when I was transferred to the internal medicine ward. And this chap, I don't know what to say. He was not a very good salesman, and he didn't strike me as a very good surgeon either. But what happened was he applied relentless pressure to me and my wife. Now, one thing that's very different culturally here in Taiwan, I think you'll be horrified when I tell you this, is that in Taiwan, your spouse can sign consent forms for surgery for you.
Yeah, that could be worrying in certain situations.
Yeah, so, you know, they culturally, it was way off, you know, way off base for me, because I'm not disabled. I'm not mentally handicapped, to the best of my knowledge. I'm not a child. And, you know, I was in full possession of my senses and my reason. And if I wanted surgery, I should be the person to sign for it. But because my wife can actually sign under these Taiwanese rules, they kept applying pressure to my wife, buttonholing her in the corridor. And the nurses double as the surgeon's eyes and ears on the ward. So every time my wife came to visit me, the nurses were alerting the surgeon and the doctors, and they were just heading straight for my room to pressure my wife to sign for me. So in the end, I had to ask my wife just to stay away from the hospital. And I think, as you know, out here, I'm a long way from the UK, where I was raised, and really I only have my wife to rely upon, and I had to send her away and just sort of tough it out by myself. But on the day before the surgery would be scheduled, the nurses and the surgeon and all his staff, his fellow doctors, they would not leave me alone, not to care for me or treat me. They wouldn't leave me alone, just endlessly pressuring me to bring my wife to the hospital so that they could apply this one last twist of pressure. And to complement their strategy, I swear that the surgeon withdrew my treatment on the last morning. So I was in a pitiful state because I really needed the pain medicine. I woke up vomiting, and the nurse's answer to my vomiting was to give me a plastic bag, which I didn't think was very effective remedy. But they just neglected me on that morning. I think it was just to soften me up for the surgery the next day. But of course, you know, I'm not an old man. This might work on an 80-year-old, but I'm only 45, so I wasn't happy with that. I could feel all my strength disappearing, and I could feel that it was just a tactic. So I brought my wife in the end, as they insisted, and I delivered a short lecture, a short monograph from my bed to the surgeon and the other doctors, not on the theme of medicine, because I'm not a doctor. I'll bow to their judgment when it comes to medicine, but I certainly know something about professional values, and I felt that this surgeon, he had a lack of them. So I delivered my short speech, and then I discharged myself from the hospital. But when I came home, I looked in the mirror. You know, I got home and looked in the mirror. I was horrified because I had truly terrible jaundice, and I was just pitifully weak. I thought, oh, my God, what have I done? But thanks to the attention of my wife and her looking after me, I'm no longer yellow. I was literally yellow, had to travel through the city to visit my workplace with a completely yellow face, like I was trying to take the mickey out of all the Asian people. So I covered my entire face in a mask. Not my Guido Fawkes mask. Yeah, not my Guy Fawkes mask, but just one of these surgical masks. That, fortunately, the culture in Taiwan, it's quite common that if you've got a cold, you just wear one of these masks. I put a new twist on it because usually, you know, it just comes up over your nose a little way. But I just applied mine to my entire face. I could see people looking at me on the train thinking, what's this person doing? Don't they know how to wear a mask? And I'm sat behind my mask thinking, what are these people? They don't know what it's like to have a completely yellow face. But actually, well, they do know what it's like to have a yellow face, but they don't know what it's like to have a yellow face but not to want to have a yellow face. Or maybe they know that too. But you take my point. I'm sort of traveling around the city incognito. And I've slowly recovered my strength now, and I'm kind of putting it behind me. Thankfully, the surgeon never had the chance to slice my sphincter, which was his ultimate aim,
nice.
Along with bumping up his bank balance. I did try and tell him, you know, there was more chance of me cutting a hole in his sphincter than him cutting a hole in mine. He didn't quite see my point there.
So you are now on the mend, then?
I am on the mend, but unfortunately, this episode meant that I couldn't eat for 6 days in total. Wow. So my wife's been moaning at me because I keep waking up at every hour just shouting that I'm hungry, basically. Feed me. Remember that ad with, I think it was for Alpha Bites, wasn't it? Remember the ad with the song, the Feed Me song with the little boy? Feed me.
Yeah, completely. Right then.
Hopefully it's not lost on you, that cultural reference there. That's where we are. I feel like eating the microphone tonight, actually. And if I could come to Rochdale, I would eat Rochdale Town Hall. I would eat the bridge. I'd eat some of the streets. You know, I'm just famished.
Right. Okay. So on today's show, we've got some interesting topics. We've got some North Korea developments, obviously, and the exchange of rhetoric that we've got. We've got some JFK assassination. New documents have been released, which is an interesting concept. We've got some quite moody developments with Google, YouTube, Facebook, social media. Internet 2 is generally what it's been known as for most people for quite a few years. And then we've got the Children's Commissioner in the UK suggesting that children's access to the internet should be dealt with as a digital 5 a day. And we all know where the 5 a day thing comes from. That's your vegetables, 5 vegetables a day. So they're now treating internet access as a diet. Then we've got some kind of politically correct or uncorrect charities. There's some interesting things with Barnardo's and the National Trust. We've got a continuation of the trans agenda. It's got some interesting developments with that this week. And we have our regular slot that appeared for the first time on our previous podcast that we did, episode 26. We call this affectionately Loon Watch. All will become clear. And if we have time at the end, we have the concept of art on prescription. So I think probably both me and Jay will have some interesting ideas to do with that, considering we have both been previously arty students. Right then. On with North Korea. Ah, well, where do we start with that then, Jay? Where would you like to kick off?
Well, I am in Taiwan, so if North Korea launch any missiles in the next hour and a half or 2 hours, I will let you know if I hear any whizzing past my window.
It'd make great radio.
It would, wouldn't it? You know, just the mother of all ends to this show. You could say, well, I'll see you on show number 28, but fortunately, my co-host Jason Kennedy, it will be dedicated to his memory.
Yeah. Well, we've got a song, Mellow Yellow, by Donovan, lined up for later.
Is that for my jaundice?
That would be, yeah.
Oh, you are too... I would say kind, but you are too cruel.
Yeah.
So Rex Tillerson has come on the scene, actually, and you know he's saying, like, he's telling the world like a bedtime story, isn't he? He's like, you can sleep, you can go to bed. North Korea won't kill you while you sleep. You know, George W. Bush stood in the ruins of 9/11 at Ground Zero and said, you know, the American people, I want you all to go shopping. And Rex Tillerson is kind of taking his cue from that. You know, we're at a geopolitical crisis point. Rex Tillerson's there, like, go to sleep, sweet dreams.
I did go
to bed wondering if there'd be anything to wake up to tomorrow. We'll come on to this, but yeah. Guam seems to be the target. And seeing as most people, Guam is literally a speck.
Yeah.
I think most of us could get along quite well without Guam, if Guam was indeed enveloped by fire. But perhaps we should just rewind a little bit and think about what all this has sort of sprung from.
Okay.
Which is the US reaction to these North Korean missile tests that are just ongoing. So it's just escalated further this week, hasn't it?
Right. So we'll kick off with an audio clip. Now, there was an interesting thing that they did on the BBC. So they first played the Fire, Fury, and Power clip, this one.
We'll be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before. Thank you.
Right, so short and sweet there. But what was interesting was that they then played President Truman warning Japan about the Hiroshima nuke that was dropped in World War II, as well as Nagasaki.
If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth.
So, that's, I mean, some people are criticising Trump. He's trying to play the strong hand. It's like bad cop, good cop. You've got Tillerson going around Indonesia and various other countries, trying to get them on side. This is generally what happens just before they try and attempt a regime change, as they call it. So you've got Tillerson going around, like you say, Jay, suggesting to people that everything's fine, carry on, go shopping, whatever it is you want to do. And then you've got Trump coming out with comments like that, basically threatening raining fire, right? So, yeah, and it's all down to these tests. And there's obviously been some developments because now it's come out in the mainstream news that there's the potential that they have now miniaturised a nuke which they can put in the nose cone of these and send them on their way. What do you make of that?
Well, we'll come on to the issue of their actual technical capabilities in a second, but let's just think about like Trump's statement. Now, apparently he had used this phrase in private, some of his aides have said, but they didn't have an inkling, apparently, that while he was speaking in public that he would go for this kind of rhetoric. So it kind of blindsided the people around Trump. So we had fire, fury, and power. Well, you know, what scared me at the start was that earth, wind, and fire were going to reform. That was my first concern. I'll take fire, fury, and power over earth, wind, and fire reforming. But it didn't seem to go down that well in US circles, this kind of rhetoric. And I've seen it labeled as being something kind of fascistic or something that's almost on a par with something that Hitler or Mussolini would come out with. Of course, also with the reference to fire, to fury, there's this kind of link to, you know, the sound and the fury. Which you may be familiar with. It's like a Shakespearean reference. Right. You know, the sound and the fury signifying nothing. So that's got the idea of just a kind of emptiness there. So they then played, like you say, that President Truman warning. And they also said in the news that Trump doesn't seem to be aware of that parallel there. So it wasn't consciously done. Donald Trump is probably old enough to have listened to President Truman. So it could be there at the back of his memory somewhere. But no, it doesn't seem deliberate. So you have, like you said, this kind of good cop, bad cop with Donald Trump playing bad cop. But the Rex Tillerson good cop role seems to have been simply thrust upon him as a response to Trump's comments. Of course, Donald Trump's pronouncements have the capacity to catalyze events. I mean, they're not trivial things, the words that he chooses to use. Actually, he should be the US's kind of highest diplomat. So it's very unusual that a president would fly off the handle in this way and use this kind of language. So other, you know, past presidents have been chiming in to condemn him as well. The interesting thing being, though, is that Trump says, if I speak like this, this is the only language that Kim guy in North Korea understands. Whereas the Kim guy in North Korea says, I have to speak like this because it's the only language Donald Trump understands. So you've got this kind of, he said, you know, finger pointing exercise going on. So that's thrown things into a very unsettled state. But now we should come on, I suppose, to this issue of what the North Koreans have actually got. I mean, they're doing missile tests, but that doesn't equate to actually having enormous technical capabilities or having solved all the problems of delivering nuclear weapons successfully. So the North Koreans themselves are making their grand claims that they can hit Guam and things like this, but who is pushing the claim that the North Koreans have miniaturized these nuclear warheads, etc.? That is actually the US government that is pushing that angle.
Yeah, there was on pewresearch.org, there was a survey done that out of all the threats that basically are on the planet at the moment, the biggest threat with most people on the planet, seemingly, asked in this survey, what was the biggest threat? Most of them turned around and said the United States. So when you've got Trump saying things like that, that's kind of fueling that side of it. But then you've got, what was it, CNN did a fantastic report. And they were using really strong words like, probably has a nuke. Right? So it seems, we'll come up again later, but this, didn't we see this in the 2003 Iraq war with weapons of mass destruction?
I think we're all old enough to remember the times that we've been hoodwinked, or even if we were not personally hoodwinked, the media has managed to hoodwink enough people for just about long enough to get their plans underway. So here, as you just pointed out, the World Socialist website. Now, for listeners of the show, they will understand that I do occasionally reference the World Socialist website. I do consider it quite a good source of critique of US policy and UK policy. It doesn't mean I subscribe to all the aims of the Fourth International, and I'm not a communist. But they have a sentence here saying, the White House, the Pentagon, and the various think tanks that elaborate US imperialist policy all claim that Pyongyang has crossed the threshold of becoming a nuclear power, having allegedly developed miniaturized warheads and intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of delivering them against a US city. And it says underneath, there's no more reason to take these assertions for good coin than there was to swallow the Bush administration's lies about Iraqi WMDs. And while Washington proclaims North Korean nukes to be an existential threat, it has assisted equally unstable and aggressive regimes in Israel, India, and Pakistan to develop similar nuclear arsenals. No, so I think that's very telling. It's not North Korea that keeps saying that they're going to send missiles to hit Alaska. That is CNN and the American government that is busy scaring the American people. Well, by saying that Hawaii, Alaska, etc., are all going to be capable of being hit. North Korea haven't said that.
No, and what's interesting as well, and the fear porn that they're actually putting out there, CNN, they're not only, I mean, all right, let's take it as a given that they've managed to fundamentally design a miniature nuke that will go into the head of a missile. But they're actually now suggesting that from a particular picture and from the nose cone on it, there is now the possibility, again, possibility in inverted commas, that says that they have countermeasures for anti-missile systems. And one of these systems, countermeasures, would be the nose cone of the rocket would break off and a load of kind of magnetic metal-covered balloons, one of which would actually have the sort of the warhead in it. They're really now painting particular pictures that not only can they have countermeasures, but one of the particular countermeasures that they're looking at is that makes it imminent that there's going to be a nuclear strike, and there is nothing that America can do to basically counteract this. Now, there is a clip that I got, and it explains this. I'll probably have to go into some detail afterwards to explain a few things, but here we go.
Another easy countermeasure is using bomblets. Instead of a single large warhead, the attack is made with many small warheads called bomblets or submunitions. The missile releases 100 or more bomblets early in flight, before the interceptors can reach them. The cloud of bomblets arcs through space, growing up to 15 miles across by the time it reaches the target. Because of this, using bomblets is the most effective way to disperse chemical and biological agents from a missile. Now, every object the defense sees is a real warhead, but there are simply too many for the defense to intercept them all. Countermeasures like these would defeat the planned missile defense system, and a defense that won't work is no defense at all.
Well, you gotta love the sinister music that they have here, don't they?
Can I come out now?
Well, this is it, right? So in the article, it's, you know, it kind of throws up a few things that they're going to have multiple warheads in one warhead. And, you know, basically your system that was, you think is going to protect you isn't. And again, like you say, this is not coming from the North Koreans. This is coming from CNN. This is coming from the government. They are scaring the hell out of their own people, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea would be, is this just the US crafting their pretext for an attack? And as you said, we had this kind of Saddam Hussein claim in The Sun that he could hit the UK with WMD within 45 minutes. Yes. And it also reminds me of another very amusing story that we talked about before, which said that Iran had a missile that they could use to strike the US. And when you read down into the small print of this article, it said, if the missile was brought to within 50 miles of the US coast on a ship.
Just hand-delivered almost.
So Iran's got a missile that you could hit the moon with if you took it within 50 miles of the moon.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've all
got missiles like that. I think actually, you know.
Yeah, I've got a stone that'll reach Taipei.
Yeah, if you flew all the way here and stood outside my window.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So we've got, like, so do the North Koreans really possess fully functional nuclear? Well, we don't know, do we?
It seems that they don't, actually. All the evidence points towards them not having, not. One thing you have to say here is when they fire these missiles, there's different firing angles. So same missile, different angles. And the test missiles, they fire at a relatively kind of low angle. So they don't exit the Earth's atmosphere and they just travel on their way and then they land somewhere near Japan. If they're going to use these ICBMs in their fullest sense, send one over to the US, then the missile has to leave the Earth's atmosphere. And apparently the big technical problem, now I'm not an expert on nuclear weapons, you know, but the big technical problem is the re-entry, that the missile doesn't burn up when it re-enters the Earth's atmosphere. And supposedly, well, the North Koreans haven't done a test that tests that part of the process. So the answer would be there's actually no evidence for the proposition that they've solved that technical problem yet.
Well, I had heard that the way experts, because we like experts on this show, if I can say the word, they'd worked out that they had a missile that was capable of doing the distance to America from the fact that when they fired that particular rocket several weeks ago, it went straight up in the air and they calculated how high it would go. And if it was at a lower trajectory, how far across the planet would it travel? And that's how they came up with the idea. They're saying, oh, yeah, they've got missiles that are now capable of going to the States.
Well, they are in terms of when they're launched. But they've not necessarily been proven that they can actually undertake that journey in and out of the Earth's atmosphere. So, yes, the rocket could fly that far, but it would have to pass these technical hurdles in order to successfully complete its mission.
But we've mentioned about CNN and that this, is it an illusion for like a pretext of the regime change that they've got in store? Now, this reminded me of a particular film. Wag the Dog. Now, you're familiar with this film, obviously, Jay. I'm sure you've seen this.
Yeah, Wag the Dog is one of those excellent movies. It would be kind of comparable, I suppose. For anyone who's not watched it, I really do suggest that you try and watch it. It's written by a really good American screenwriter called David Mamet. Really wrote some brilliant stuff for the theatre. And the other movie, which I think anyone who's not seen it, it's worth going and checking out, that I'd fit alongside Wag the Dog, is Network,
which is
the movie that brought, you know, Howard Beale, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, to public notice. So some of our younger listeners, you might not have checked these movies out yet. Wag the Dog is kind of from the late 80s.
Oh, Network, no, is isn't that...
70s.
No, I do believe, actually, Wag the Dog, I think, was 97.
Oh, really? It was that late?
Yeah,
I watched it while I was in the US, actually. It does feature Nashville, which I just visited at the time. So there's a little part where they're recording the country song. They go to Nashville to do it.
Yes.
Okay, so it's 90s. network, like I say, I am correct. It's in the 70s. So in Wag the Dog, it's the phrase, as it indicates, it's about how a small clique of people can manipulate the public because they control the media and they've got all kinds of technology at their disposal. And it just shows it from the inside how events can, pseudo events can be crafted for public consumption in order to gain support for policies that you've already, you know, decided upon. So I think you can go and play a clip that kind of demonstrates this in action.
So this is a producer that is now creatively creating a fake war.
Ooh, the public.
They gotta know.
Yes.
Stan, get with us. Who killed Kennedy? I read the first draft of the Warren Report. It says he was killed by a drunk driver. You watch the Gopher. What do you see day after day? The one smart bomb falling down a chimney. The truth? I was in the building when we shot that shot. We shot it in a studio, Falls Church, Virginia, 1/10 scale model of a building.
Is that true?
How the f*** do we know? You take my point?
Yes. All right. Okay. And you want me to do what?
We want you to produce.
You want me to produce your war?
Not a war. It's a pageant. We need a theme, a song, some visuals. We need, you know, it's a pageant. It's like the Oscars. That's why we came to you.
I never won an Oscar.
And that's a damn shame you didn't. But you produced the Oscars.
Yes, indeed I did. You know, you're a writer. That's your script.
You're a director. But if you're the producer, what did you do? See, nobody knows what you do. The producer, I mean, all he's got is the credit. You see? Some plaques on the wall. They don't know what we do.
Stan.
Don't get me started.
Stan.
Yes?
If you never won an Oscar, how would you like an ambassadorship?
An ambassadorship?
Yeah.
That's my payoff.
Well, you tell me what you want.
Hell, I just do it for the fun of it. For a story to tell.
Oh, no, you couldn't tell anybody.
Oh, hey, listen, I'm just kidding.
No, you couldn't tell anybody.
No, I know. It's just a figure of speech. No. It's a pageant.
It's a pageant. That's what it is.
Country's a war.
It's Miss America in your bird parks.
Why Albanian?
Because.
Well, they have to have something we want.
Well, I'm sure they do.
What do we have that they want?
A little freedom.
Well, why would they want that?
Oppressed?
No. F*** freedom. They want to destroy the godless Satan of the United. They want to destroy our way of life, all right? Okay. The president is in China. He is dealing with the dispatch of the B-3 bomber to Albania. Why? Why? Help me.
Well, I mean, what he... Well, that's...
Well, all right. Let's see. Geopolitically, if you...
We just found out they have the bomb. We just found out they have the bomb.
That's good. Yeah.
And, no, wait a second. Wait a second. Wait. No, the bomb's not there because they'd have to have a rocket in that, right? And they are a bunch of wogs. No, cross out. All right, so it's a suitcase bomb.
I didn't even know I said that.
It's a suitcase bomb. You don't need missiles.
You put a bomb in a suitcase, right? Mm-hmm. It's a suitcase bomb.
Yeah, suitcase, that's good. That's
a suitcase bomb?
Yes?
It's a suitcase bomb. When it's cooking, it's cooking.
We're cooking, and it's in Canada. All right? Albanian terrorists have placed a suitcase bomb in Canada in an attempt to infiltrate the bomb into the USA.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
That's good. That's terrific. And I'll tell you why. It is cost effective.
Well, it's producing. That's what it is.
No, it's really good.
Right. So what we would get as the general public is that last little bit you heard there is that's what they've just made up. And that becomes what, you know, on the TV, that's what the rest of us would see.
It's a little like that story about the headline was that Russia had hacked the electricity grid in Vermont. Remember that one a few months ago?
Right, yeah.
And when it unwound, it turned out that, one, the electricity grid hadn't been hacked. Two, it was just a single laptop which wasn't connected to the grid. And three, on the laptop was just some malware which could have come from anywhere. But as you say, the headline is the thing to scare you. And if the story just unravels afterwards, sometimes the headline alone will just kind of do its job and damn the details. So as you say, I thought you were going to play the whole movie there. We got the idea. That was Dustin Hoffman, for anyone wondering who it was. He plays the producer, and he's got his catchphrase all the way through as things get deeper and deeper. He's got his, this is nothing. You know, this is nothing.
So, what do we do with the idea that if we're looking at CNN and the mainstream media propagating the idea without any concrete proof that there is indeed a miniaturized nuke making its way over the oceans? I mean, most people are going to be watching this and quite sincerely worried, actually.
Well, it's one of those things, isn't it, where we do often talk about this on the show, that the media side of it can just be a spectacle.
Yeah.
But there are real-life consequences that may emerge from this spectacle. So it's a mix, isn't it? Are we right to be worried? I'd say what most people can see through this and see that the thing we're most likely to see, if we do see any kind of disaster, is that the disaster will be visited upon the people of North Korea, rather than this idea that the US is going to lose some city on its western seaboard. Now, Mike Pence, I believe, is the vice president, isn't he?
He is indeed.
Mike Pence made a statement which echoes, in a way, the Madeleine Albright, the 500,000 children's deaths in Iraq, the price is worth it. He said, I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but it's close enough. He said, if these people are going to die, they're going to die over there. If people are going to die in their hundreds of thousands, they won't die here. They'll die there. That just reveals this logic. And as you rightly pointed out, there's a lot of memes buzzing around the internet at the moment. And I saw one this morning that kind of reinforces or reiterates what you just alluded to. Right. And it says, it's got a picture of the American flag and then the North Korean flag. It says, one of these countries dropped 26,000 bombs on other countries last year and has never been attacked. And the other one dropped no bombs and hasn't threatened anyone. The one is the US and the other is North Korea. And we're also seeing, aren't we, that when you talk about the unstable leaders in this situation, that most people are more terrified of Donald Trump as this unstable leader with the nuclear codes than Kim in North Korea, who at the most has got 60, supposedly, of these little missiles. But each one of his missiles is only the equivalent of a Nagasaki or a Hiroshima. They're not like the US nuclear missiles, which are, I believe, like orders of magnitude more deadly than the ones the US deployed 72 years ago this week in Japan. And the thought that Donald Trump has got the codes for the you probably know this from The Watchmen, or you may have known about it before, but they call it the football, right?
Okay, go and explain the concept of football then.
Well, there's this thing called the football, which follows the president around, and it's a bag that's shaped vaguely like an American football, and it goes everywhere that the president goes. It's a little like that briefcase in Escape from New York, if you're familiar with that movie, that's chained to the president's arm. And what it is it contains the nuclear codes. So it goes everywhere with the president. So wherever he is, on Air Force One or wherever he is, he can always launch the nuclear missiles. And there's been some additional reporting the last few days that said Donald Trump showed an absolute passion for nuclear weapons when he was being briefed and becoming president. And he asked repeatedly in meetings, and he did make the comment, what's the point in having these missiles if we don't use them? Which is, of course, a truly terrifying prospect. To complete the movie references for this segment, I would point to Donald Trump as being a kind of Greg Stilson figure from The Dead Zone. Are you familiar with that movie?
The Dead Zone, yes.
Now, for anyone who hasn't seen this one too, I'm sorry, this is not a film movie podcast. I don't usually watch that many movies anymore, but The Dead Zone is from a Stephen King novel. It also became a TV series, not really very good. But the movie is an 80s movie directed by David Cronenberg, very good director from Canada. And the story is very simple. A man has a car accident, and after the car accident, he develops these powers to see the future. So if he touches someone or an object, he will have a jolt and he'll have an experience of the future. So in this way, he predicts like that a nurse's house is on fire. And he also predicts like that this congressman or this senator, this politician's son is trapped under the ice. And what happens in this fateful encounter is he shakes hands with, I believe it's Charlie Sheen, isn't
yes,
it? Or Martin.
Is. Yeah, playing Charlie the Sheen. President.
Charlie Sheen plays this politician called Greg Stilson, who's running for office. And when he shakes the hands of our hero, he sees that this politician will become president and he will launch a nuclear attack that destroys the planet because of his kind of religious beliefs. Now, apparently Trump is not religious, but there is some evangelical in his circle who has come out this week in the midst of this North Korean crisis, like one of these Islamic mullahs, and sort of pronounced a fatwa on North Korea saying this is God's will, you know, if we destroy North Korea. That's truly terrifying as well. So in the movie, what happens is our hero takes it upon himself. You know, the future is not written. He's just seeing one version of it. So he assassinates Greg Stilson. He's unsuccessful in assassinating him. He doesn't kill him. But what happens is at this town hall, when he tries to shoot him, Greg Stilson very cowardly picks up a child from the audience and uses it as a human shield. And as he lays dying, Stilson stands over the hero, and the hero grabs his hand as he dies, and he sees a vision of Stilson with the cover of Time magazine, which Donald Trump is often on the cover of, actually. And in the cover of Time magazine is the shot of Stilson holding the child in front of his face, and he then hears a gunshot, Stilson blowing his brains out, and the blood goes all over the Time magazine cover. You know, you don't need to watch it now, do you?
That's usually what I do as it goes.
Now I can list, you know, second cameraman, key grip, executive producer. I can read out the credits. We're finished.
So, right, this Jeremy Scarhill interview with John Pfeffer, is it? Who's? I'm never.
Yeah, not. It's not. It's not Michelle Pfeiffer. It's. It's her brother. It's her brother, John Pfeffer.
Right. Okay.
So, I chose this one. We're kind of going on a bit at length about North Korea, but the reason I chose this clip was because often you'll hear the Trump refrain that China can kind of step in and solve this crisis at a stroke because China is North Korea's closest ally. So this is true that China is very close to North Korea, but this idea that North Korea listens to China and would change its policies based on what China says or Chinese pressure is at odds with the truth as set out by John Pfeffer. And I say the truth there. If anyone listens to the, I don't know how much of the Scahill or Scarhill interview you listen to, Dave, but one thing is for sure, it lasts about an hour, and John Pfeffer certainly does know an awful lot about North Korea. I'll take his word over that of Donald Trump's. So if you play this segment, it's kind of explaining. And actually, the U.S. and U.S. Christians played quite a role in shaping this awful North Korean regime, as we may discover if you'll play this. Apologies, but it might be a rather long clip, but it's a good clip.
You have a society that is cut off from the outside world, and you start to tap into the new generations and ensure that they're kind of brainwashed into believing that this is the truth and this is the way the world is. When did that start in North Korea around Kim Il-sung's identity?
Well, Kim Il-sung came from a very Christian family, and the northern part of Korea was very strongly Christian during the late 19th and early 20th century. In fact, Pyongyang was really the center of Christian theology. Many people came to Pyongyang to study, including Billy Graham's wife studied in Pyongyang at the theology center there, which was why Billy Graham was so interested in North Korea.
Now God doesn't have a body like yours. He doesn't look like an American. He doesn't look like a Korean. God has no body. God is a spirit. And because God is a spirit, he can be everywhere at the same time.
Kim Il-sung bases his cult of personality on Christian roots. So you have, for instance, the father and the mother and the son, Kim Il-sung, his first wife, and their first son, Kim Jong-il, form this kind of trinity in the North Korean ideology, very similar to a Christian trinity. Kim Il-sung, through this period, is able to add on to this cult of personality with some indigenous aspects. I mean, Of course, it was identified as a communist country, but gradually, over the decades, those communist elements become superseded by more nationalist elements. And of course, the ideology that many people are familiar with is the Juche ideology that Kim Il-sung developed, which is effectively a self-reliant ideology, says that North Korea really can't depend on other countries. So the notion of self-reliance, of nationalist sovereignty, extremely important to North Korean ideology. And Kim Il-sung grafts this onto the personality cult so that you have a rich kind of nationalist underpinning to create a kind of organic one mind, one body ideology, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting what he says there, actually.
Yeah, very interesting sort of comment there. So this idea that China can step in is something of a fallacy, and it's just another stick to beat the Chinese with. Doesn't mean that the ultimate aim here of the US isn't, you know, kind of trying to curtail China, ultimately. We've had this pivot to Asia that Obama kind of orchestrated, and we've seen this growing US kind of campaign against China. And of course, Trump has led the way, saying that previous presidents have been way too soft on China and all this stuff about how they've ripped us off in terms of the trading arrangements, and it's time to get tough with the Chinese. So that response just kind of spoke to that. Now, I think we're almost done with this, but we should just, before we move on, there's just two bits of light relief. The first bit of light relief would be the UK reaction to this North Korean crisis. So I don't know if you saw this in the Daily Mail, but it was that we will stand by our US ally. British MPs warn a North Korean strike on Guam could trigger a UK military response as they liken possible attack to Pearl Harbor. So there's the UK standing shoulder to ankle with their American brothers. So I did find that one kind of ludicrous. The US has got 6,800 nuclear warheads, supposedly, and the only ones the UK has got are actually American ones on loan. So I'm not really sure that they need our help. But MPs, I don't know whether they just want to tempt Pyongyang into hurling one our way as well, just signing everyone's death warrant there for the UK population. I think they would have been better just keeping it buttoned for the minute. And then the other piece of light relief, I don't know if you'd like to play it as the last clip for this segment, would be this terribly famous woman in Southeast Asia who is the sort of the Hugh Edwards of North Korean newscasting. And there's no translation forthcoming, but I think you should just give people a sample of how she is passing on the news of this crisis to the people of North Korea.
셋째, 우리 국가와 인민을 상대로 저지르고 있는 미국의 극악한 범죄의 대가를 천백배로 결산할 것이다. 참혹한 전쟁으로 우리의 강토를 피바다 불바다 속에 잠궜으며 우리의 사상과 제도를 없애버리고 세기를 이어 수단과 방법을 가리지 않고 광분하고 있는 미국이 저들의 땅덩어리가 대양건노이 수 무사리라고 생각한다면 그보다 더 큰 오산은 없다.
So that's how you deliver news from your beloved leader with some gusto.
Yeah, with patriotic fervor. I think, you know, for $500,000 a year, Hugh Edwards could do a significantly better job. I'd like to see him approach sort of half that level of enthusiasm. The other point I would note there for any of our more technically minded listeners is that if you play that clip backwards, you'll hear the chorus of Strawberry Fields Forever.
You see, the South Asia has been in the news again on another level, in the sense that allegedly within the next 100 years, well, by the end of this century, the humidity is going to be so high that, human survival will be unlikely, you know. So if it ain't the nuclear war that gets you, it'll be the humidity, Jay.
Yeah, well, actually, if we turn towards the Taiwan weather forecast, do you remember when it was the Fast Show, wasn't it, where they used to have that weather forecast with the Scorchio, you know, the kind of Latin American weather forecast where it was just blindingly hot everywhere all of the time. Well, here in Taiwan, we're into the fourth week now where the temperatures are just flatlined at 38 degrees C. So my wife, even though she's born and raised in Taiwan. She can't go out at the moment because she's having problems with her skin because the heat is so intense. Unfortunately, for those who haven't seen me in person, you won't know this, but I do have one or two drops of Mediterranean blood that help to protect me from this onslaught. But I don't know going forwards. It's the hottest summer here for 100 years, they said. I don't know going forwards if it keeps getting much hotter what I'm going to do. As you just pointed out, the humidity will be so intense and the heat will be so intense. You're kind of getting cooked from the inside every time you walk down the street.
Yeah. So,
maybe Rochdale would become the only habitable place in the universe.
Oh, man, that would be a turn of events, wouldn't it?
Imagine that. You'd have all of these billionaires relocating to Rochdale, kicking out all of the local people. So the mayor of Rochdale would be Mark Zuckerberg. And then the guys living, maybe if you're just a regular, like, multimillionaire, you're just living in, like, a reconditioned council house or something. But if you're Bill Gates, you know, he'll have the best gaff in Rochdale.
Gaff!
Manor!
Yeah, pad. Right, so moving on then. What's this about the CIA JFK new documents that have come out? This one completely passed me by. I see that, you know, you're saying that this could be an early example of blowback. Now, I remember on a previous show, you explained what blowback was. So when the intelligence services do certain kind of, you know, nefarious plans and schemes that sometimes, like, you know, funding terrorist groups to take over another country, well, eventually that terrorist group will come back and haunt you. But is it along those lines?
Yeah, we did talk about it before, the concept of blowback. It's mostly associated with this American historian called Chalmers Johnson, right, who wrote a book called The Sorrows of Empire. He wrote like a trilogy. They're still regarded as some of the finest, you know, works of 20th century American history. So he wrote about this. Now, sometimes the concept gets abused. It's like widened out further than it was intended to be. But as you pointed out, you defined it correctly. It's the unforeseen consequences of covert action. So it's not to do with regular policy making. That covert action part is important. So what happens is, a little like you pointed out with Wag the Dog, you'll have some kind of below the surface activity going on, which leads to some event that is kind of visible to the naked eye, yeah, to the global media, which will then be reported through a very narrow frame, often in highly, you know, coloured way, or perhaps outright propaganda in the way it's presented to the public. I would suggest that at the moment there is one going on which is even more intense and more obvious than the North Korean situation, and that is the manufactured crisis in Venezuela that's unfolding at the minute.
Yes.
And we will return to that a little later on the show. So the CIA, everyone knows who they are, but maybe not everyone knows their history. The CIA kind of begin just after World War II. Up until that point, the main purveyors in the West of covert action were the British. And so the CIA was trying to sort of bring themselves up to the same level as the British. And so the first, the handover in terms of these operations was in 1953. And that was the coup in Iran. The British were planning it. And there are documents that have come out just this week, because the British have always refused to release any documents that tie the British definitively to that coup. But the Americans have released some documents this week that are the first concrete evidence of British involvement. So the British there were approaching this member of the Roosevelt clan. He's called Kermit, rather strangely. So he's called Kermit Roosevelt. So this has emerged this week. So the CIA was instrumental in taking on that coup. But this one relates to the assassination of JFK, which happened in November of 1963. So the Warren Commission, the report into the assassination of JFK. Now, the CIA agreed, basically, all their evidence internally pointed towards Oswald acting alone and being the gunman. But why did he do it? Why did he target Kennedy? This is the new evidence that came out this week. So there's a story on Politico website. And what was found was that there was a newspaper that Lee Harvey Oswald used to read religiously down in Louisiana. And in 1963, in September, it carried a story about U.S. government assassination attempts directed against Fidel Castro, the revolutionary leader of Cuba. Now, I don't know if you know this much about Lee Harvey Oswald, apart from like his end game, but his hero, despite the fact Lee Harvey Oswald was in the U.S. military, his hero was Fidel Castro. And he did interact quite a lot with Cuban officials in the U.S. and in Mexico, in kind of wishing to be of service somehow to the Cuban regime. So he read this article, they believe, and this would set up like a chain. You know, this would set up the chain of events for why Oswald targeted Kennedy for assassination. It was because he was outraged that the U.S., the CIA, was targeting his hero for assassination. So that's why he hatched his plot, you see, to go after Kennedy. Of course, the CIA, the reports that came out this week showed that the CIA knew about this newspaper report. They knew that Oswald had probably read it, and they also realized that it could have been instrumental in triggering his plot. But of course, this would be an early example of blowback, because it was the CIA that was trying to bump off Castro, you know, with the poison cigars and these kind of exploding cigarette lighters and all the rest of that.
So, yeah, it's some interesting backstory with Oswald, actually. Not to mention the fact that people have tried shooting the same amount of bullets with the same rifle and found it almost impossible, if not impossible. So, yeah, intriguing.
It's like the Bill Hicks sketch, isn't there, where he says he went to the Texas, the Dallas Book Depository, and he said that you're not allowed to get right next to the window to see the angle that Oswald supposedly got his shots off from, but Bill Hicks, the late comedian, was a huge kind of conspiracy nut for the JFK. And he said the reason, he said, it doesn't even matter when you're looking there, even if you can't go to the window. He said the natural reaction is to just turn around and start clicking your fingers and saying, am I allowed to swear on air this week if I'm quoting someone?
Probably best not.
All right, I'll paraphrase.
Okay.
No effing way. No effing way, you know, did anyone shoot the president in a moving car amount of times from that window with a rifle. So Bill Hicks was always kind of highly skeptical of the idea that Oswald pulled it off. But the interesting thing that was also in this Politico report, which we sort of have to add to the lexicon alongside fake news and alternative facts, was that when the CIA were helping the Warren Commission with their investigation, you know, they didn't disclose this newspaper article and this fact that Oswald may have read it. And what they said they were doing was they were providing the best truth to the Warren Commission.
So there's multiple truths then, and they've selected the best one.
And the CIA had the best one that they'd chosen. They'd chosen the best one.
Oh, that's... Well, it seems that we've been living in a post-fact world for a lot longer than we think.
Yeah, I believe so. But on that note, I think that rounds off the first hour of the show very well. And perhaps we could just close out by having our first song of the week.
Oh, right, okay then. Well, this is Donovan Hurdy-Gurdy Man. It's a great track. Hope you enjoy, everyone.
Like a star in my vast sleep, I opened my eyes to take a peek, to find that I was by the sea, gazing with tranquility. Just then, when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love, then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love. Histories of ages.
and shadows cast down through all eternity, the crying of humanity. 'Tis then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing songs of love. Then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing songs of love.
Well, how good is that then, man?
I did supply a little trivia there for you, I believe, when I pointed out that John Bonham, Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin played on that song, although the precise nature of their contributions has been disputed, you know, but yes, they do have some work on that wonderful song.
Right, so next topic. I was a bit depressed when I came across this over the last several days. I mean, we've done a lot of stuff, actually, when it comes to social media and, you know, algorithms and how they're filtering out certain elements of news that they don't really want you to pay attention to, stuff like this. This, Google also incorporating YouTube, are now stifling traffic to... What would you call them? Alternative news sites? I mean, I'd call them news sites.
They are predominantly left-wing alternative news sites, and left-wing here generally translates as providing a harsh critique of US domestic and foreign policy. So this story has been broken by the World Socialist website, and it is an analytics-driven story, because what they document is the search terms. The 45 most popular search terms that would have directed people previously to the World Socialist website, all of them now don't direct to the website. All of them are dead. So imagine if you administer a website, suddenly the top 45 terms that would bring people to your site no longer work. That's what's happened to them. So their traffic has decreased by 67%. And what happened from this is that they've also contacted other leading left-wing alternative news sources, and they found, for example, I can list a few of these, not all of them. Alternet, down 63% from Google. Globalresearch.ca. Now, do you read this site?
No, I'm not familiar with that one.
Well, it is a good site, and they kind of aggregate a lot. A lot of these sites share their content with one another. They kind of, you know, syndicate and aggregate. Now, it does have kind of very fringe stuff on there, so I don't tend to use it as my first port of call, but they do also carry lots of good articles, you know, that have been circulated. Consortium News, which is the Robert Parry outfit. Now, I don't know if you know who Robert Parry is.
Not a fan.
Robert Parry's main journalistic scoop is he broke Iran-Contra.
Ah, right, I remember that.
In the 80s, and he's been thoroughly demonized by the the mainstream media in the US ever since. For anyone who wants to understand that, well, maybe Gary Webb is better known. The late Gary Webb, who broke the the stories of how the CIA was running drugs into California during the 80s.
That would be another film reference. American Gangster is based around that.
Yeah, Gary Webb is kind of finally receiving his due, but he was chased out of the newspaper business and eventually took his own life, just despondent at the kind of treatment he'd received. He's a hero for many for disclosing those truths. Socialist Worker, which maybe we don't care about them quite as much as some of the other ones here, but they don't carry so much news, down by 47%. Common Dreams, which is just your regular fare. I mean, these are not extreme sites. These are what would usually be called kind of progressive sites. And Truth Out, which is another very good site. And here's one that I do read religiously, is Counterpunch. Counterpunch is a very good site because they do aggregate all the best of the kind of alternative media in one spot, and they really do filter them well. The only criticism would be some of their articles are a little bit long, especially, I don't know why, but as soon as someone becomes a professor, all their articles double in length. And the last one here is The Intercept is down 19%. So what does it mean? It means that Google, under the guise of fighting fake news, is censoring an entire section of political viewpoints from its search results. So it began with the crusade against fake news and it ends like this. So there, the WSWS is kind of furious. And what they've realized is since they published this story is they're having even more of these alternative left-wing sites getting in touch with them to say, yeah, hold on, we're suffering too. So it seems that Google has rolled this out across the board. There's a Google engineer. Don't know if you've seen this one, but this is interesting because to you and me, the outcome is censorship. But Google's engineer, of course, has a technical explanation. And, you know, these technical explanations masquerade as kind of being neutral and objective. But what it's about is they're improving the quality of the search. And here, quality seems to be synonymous with corporate media. Now, every week we talk about this, don't we? Literally every show. The whole reason we even have a show is because the one thing the corporate media doesn't have is much credibility. And the one thing it doesn't really provide is much quality. But in Google land and Facebook land, they still seem to want to push this idea that the only media you can trust are these big corporate giants.
Well, funny enough, there was a survey that came out, I think it was last week I saw it, that said, you know, gave you a list of trusted and the least trusted news sites. And the likes of the BBC and so on came out on top. And it was like, I'll give over, pull the other one, it's got bells on it.
Well, WSWS has a good sentence here, right, sort of turning it on its head. The phenomenon of fake news is itself the principal fake news story of 2017. Yeah. In its origins and propagation, it has all the well-known characteristics of what used to be called CIA misinformation campaigns, aimed at discrediting left-wing opponents of state and corporate interests.
What was the... was it the CIA? They had Operation Mockingbird, wasn't it, where they would infiltrate the media?
CIA had entire newspapers, Dave.
Yeah, but it was Mockingbird. I mean, because it's still said now that certain news presenters, especially in America and in, like Fox and all this sort of stuff, CNN and MSNBC, that they're basically CIA plants is the conspiracy. But then when you look at stuff like Operation Mockingbird, where, and I think it was back in the 60s, they drew up plans to infiltrate news organisations to put certain messages out into the public domain, into the public consciousness.
Well, absolutely. And journalists are the people to control, to sort of pass this information on. Now, some people just in America, there's this idea that if you're serving the government, serving the CIA, then you're just being a good patriot. So I think often in for the CIA, they don't have to do much and they don't need much leverage. It's not blackmail. People are just anxious to do what they can. And of course, they've always used journalists that travel abroad. It's always been good cover for intelligence operatives to seek information. And also they debrief journalists as a matter of routine. When any US journalist returns from North Korea, they will be debriefed on what they saw there. You know, and apparently it's just really can be just very innocent information that is always just used to build up a picture. So they'll ask questions like, what condition were the roads in? You know, what were people eating? You know, what did you see any military vehicles going past on a regular basis? You know, they're always just trying to build up the picture, particularly with these very closed regimes. Now, in Ronald Reagan's day, I believe, if you look it up, he had a kind of turn of phrase which he used for when this misinformation would kick in. He used to call it the Wurlitzer, because it would play any tune you wanted. So that was how he referred to the mass media and the way that the intelligence agencies and the military could kind of interface with it. You know, just play any tune you want to the American people. And the point I raised there is that it's not just the CIA. Glenn Greenwald did a huge, of The Intercept, did a huge investigation of the way military figures with interests in defense contractors were appearing on all the news networks as these independent experts and always agitating for more war, more military spending, more interventions. And despite him showing how transparent these connections were by the end of his investigation, these generals never ceased to be invited back onto the networks to spout this stuff. And these guys were guys who'd kind of departed the military but retained their links. But the Pentagon itself, when they were headed towards the last Iraq war, they had this circle, this pool of military officials that they would, you know, send out. But anyone that they invited always had to kind of stay on message. And if you said slightly the wrong thing, then you wouldn't be invited on the networks for a few days. So, yeah, this entire environment, which is like a long-running 24/7 psyop of the US corporate media, is what Google and Facebook believe is the only kind of news diet that the consumer should have available to them.
Well, interesting. We'll get to Facebook just in a moment. But obviously, Google owns YouTube. And there's a guy that I've followed on and off, a guy called Mark Dice. He does a lot of conspiracy. He does a lot of media deconstruction sort of stuff. And he did some homework.
As this Gizmodo article explains, YouTube has a new naughty corner for controversial religious and, quote, supremacist videos. Well, what does that mean, you ask? YouTube has clarified how it plans to handle videos that don't violate any of its policies, but still contain, quote, offensive religious and supremacist content. They're going to hide them and make sure that they can't make any money. In a blog post today, YouTube provided a better sense of what that stance entails. Now, when YouTube decides a flagged video doesn't break content policy, but still contains controversial religious or, quote, supremacist content, the video will be put in a limited state. Here, the video will exist in a sort of limbo where it won't be recommended or monetized. It also won't be included in the suggested videos or allowed to have comments or likes on it. This new approach will apply to the desktop version of YouTube within the next few weeks and on mobile soon after that. Right-wing alternative media figures and, quote, conspiracy theorists have been complaining for weeks that YouTube is already manipulating the algorithms to limit their reach and revenue. In fact, yesterday YouTube deleted the entire channel of a Canadian college professor, this guy, Jordan B. Peterson, who dares to say such hateful things like there are only two genders on his YouTube channel. And thankfully, after it started making headlines, here's one from the Washington Times, people started applying pressure to YouTube, and they probably reluctantly restored his channel. YouTube has also admitted that they're literally going to start manipulating the search results for certain topics and show people videos to try to debunk the ideas that they're looking up. I'm not kidding. So, for example, if you're looking for a video about why it's crazy to say that there's 85 different genders, they're going to manipulate the search results to show videos saying why there should be 85 different genders. We've started to roll out features from Jigsaw's redirect method to YouTube. When people search for sensitive keywords on YouTube, they will be redirected towards a playlist of curated YouTube videos that directly confront and debunk violent extremist messages, which also just means the truth. We also continue to amplify YouTube voices speaking out against hate and radicalization through our YouTube Creators for Change program. What are the YouTube Creators for Change, you may wonder? It's a group of social justice warrior YouTubers who have been chosen and just given a bunch of money in order to help them produce more videos. Oh, and by the way, who did YouTube team up with to help them determine which videos are sensitive and extremist and offensive? The ADL. The same organization which literally labeled Pepe the Frog, a cartoon frog, as a hate symbol. Pepe the Frog designated a hate symbol by the ADL.
Well, in a way, that particular thing that you pointed out to me the other day, Jay, when, and I've seen this a lot in the recent weeks, where I'm on, say, Facebook, and obviously, we have like the concept of an echo chamber. So a lot of people that I see on my Facebook are going to be kind of thinking and posting similar things generally. There are a handful of people on my Facebook who I've never seen a post from. That can't be possible, can it? Unless you're dealing with algorithms. But you click on a link that would normally take you externally to another part of the internet. Instead, you end up on another page in Facebook.
Yeah, these are these things called Facebook fast pages. And what Facebook does is it partners with media organizations to give them to load their stories inside Facebook, because supposedly there's a better, you know, reading rate than if it goes to Google Chrome, etc. And of course, they also load faster because you're not leaving the app. So this fast loading part has become something that Google and Facebook are now saying that they're going to prioritize fast loading content. So fast loading content is there synonymous with people that are paying Facebook to carry their content or just corporate media. So as you rightly point out, they're kind of using this technical arguments to create this kind of two-tier service, so that always you're going to see what they want you to see rather than where your interests would actually guide you. The other thing about that guy's clip there is he talked about how, for example, maybe you search for something about, let's just choose, he said gender.
Yeah.
So you search on there's only two genders and you get something telling you that there's 85 genders. You get the opposite of what you're searching for. That echoes the UK, part of the UK Prevent strategy, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but people searching for jihadi content online run into web pages put there by the British government that say you're searching for jihadi content. That breaks UK law. Not a good idea. If you would like to call this number, you know, this kind of thing. So they've done that deliberately to kind of try and redirect people away from extremism to stop this radicalization taking place. Now, you can argue the rights and wrongs of that, but that is a very limited case. You know, when we're using the internet, we're not going to run into those UK government pages. But to apply that to an entire platform like YouTube, where, you know, people are not being radicalized in this sense, I don't believe, and to just apply it to billions of users and millions of content producers seems to me a lot more worrying than when the UK government does it to try and tackle a few homegrown jihadis.
Well, especially on the likes of YouTube, where there's quite a lot of people who get a sponsorship for their videos. And what this in effect does is close all of that down.
Yeah, well, it's like the Google action against those alternative sites. They depend upon their position in the search results to bring traffic, because they need that traffic in order to satisfy their advertisers. So if you lose 50% of your site visits, the logical consequence is you're likely to lose 50% of your ad revenue too. Some of these ad revenue programs, of course, the most popular ones are operated by Google itself.
Well, yeah.
So clearly for Google, shutting off the viewpoint is more important than Google's bottom line. It's silent weapons for, what do they say, silent weapons for quiet wars.
Yeah, exactly. Did you know that Google they've got a court case against them? Did you know about that?
I think there's 1,000 court cases against Google.
Well, I found this little nugget.
After the uproar The job was lost, wasn't it?
It was indeed. And we heard a memo came out from Sundar Pichai, he is the Google CEO overall, saying that the comments that were in this basically anti-diversity memo written by James Damore violate our code of conduct and cross the line by advancing harmful gender stereotypes in our workplace. That's the reasoning that he's lost his job. We understand that was confirmed. He confirmed his own dismissal in an email. And I just want to point out some of the elements that were in this so-called memo, which he titled Google's Ideological Echo Chamber. He says, yes, there are different traits between men and women, and maybe they're behind the difference in leadership breakdown and why we don't have equality at the top in terms of men and women. He says women have more neuroticism. He says they look for more work-life balance, and that men have a higher drive for status. Of course, all this whetting the appetite of those who are really in the push towards diversity and feel that this is unfair and not representative overall. But of course, this has created a backlash on the other side of things, because for those that propose diversity, there are also many that say, look, perhaps on the if you're a right-wing conservative, you're actually against freedom of speech here.
Yeah, and it comes as it faces a lawsuit, doesn't it, from the US Department of Justice.
And I think this is what is ironic, when there is being a badge attached to Google many a times, that perhaps it is left-leaning. In fact, this is what was brought up at its most recent shareholder meeting back in June. A shareholder said, look, perhaps because of your political views, conservatives wouldn't be welcome at Google. And the executives tried to speak out against that, saying, no, no, they would indeed be welcome. And in fact, Danielle Brown, she is a relatively new VP for diversity, for integrity, for governance. She said, look, we are happy to host people of difficult political views, she said, but perhaps you will be penalised. Perhaps it will be against the code of conduct. But it's ironic when you're a left-leaning, said so by many, thought to be left-leaning, that actually there's a court case from coming from none other than the US Department of Labour, in fact, saying that this company systematically discriminates against women. And notably, when you look at the numbers, Mark, they don't exactly speak volumes over at Google. 69% of the workforce is male, 80% of the tech workforce are male. That leaves, what, just 30% in the entirety of Google as women?
Yeah. You see, there's also an interesting point that's come up where numerous individuals who basically are members of Google management structure, they've been caught bragging Google has an internal intranet, I suppose you would call it, and they've been bragging on there. They call it Wrong Think Blacklist. So in that clip where you heard, you know, you're discriminating against people who may have different political ideals to you. Well, if that was indeed the case, you would then be put on this blacklist, and your basically career would be kiboshed as a result of it. And they're bragging about it. So, I mean, this is, they're on one hand, they're saying that we're going to look after you, we're going to filter out fake news, and actually, they're doing exactly what they want behind closed doors.
Well, I think as kind of on the level of their business, their search, then Google is resolutely kind of pro-war, pro-business, anti-regulation, anti-tax. You know, they line up in that way in terms of their business. They're just one more US corporation. In terms of the politics of their workplace, you then find this kind of liberal left tyranny at work, as you just pointed out, under the banner of diversity, which is presented as an unalloyed good. Anything which challenges that diversity, as you just pointed out, would be called, in 1984 style, wrong think.
Yeah.
Now, as the guy who wrote the memo pointed out, and I'll just address a couple of the things. One, he said, he's arguing against the very hard constructionist position. So what is that? The constructionist position would say that biology is irrelevant, that there's no arguments you can make about differences between men and women that can be founded upon biology without you immediately, you know, disqualifying yourself from decent company. So he says in his memo, these people see every single difference in performance between men and women as having its root in inequality. It can never be biologically based. It's always socially constructed. And he kind of pushes back against that with some insights from kind of evolutionary psychology, a little bit of personal observation, and some of his experience of what it requires to get ahead in this kind of tech sector. So because of his mentions of biology, he's immediately disqualified from the Polite Society of Google, and ultimately he loses his job. Now, can I take another one of his claims? Men are more hungry for status. Okay. Now, there's an anthropological term which you might know. I'll introduce it here. And have you heard of this word? Hypergamy.
I have. No idea what it means.
Okay. All right, so I'll just say what it is. I'm sure all our listeners already know what it means. So hypergamy is the concept that women marry men from who basically are richer or better positioned within the social structure than they are themselves.
Gold diggers.
So this would be the idea that most women would prefer to marry or aim to marry a man who is wealthier from a better background than they are themselves. Now, if you look around in our Western societies, it's extremely unusual to see women marrying men with less status than themselves. Would you agree?
Yeah, actually. I mean, it's an interesting point you bring that up. I hadn't really thought about that, but yeah, that's my sense.
So the fact that men are pursuing status,
yeah,
you know, if you want to be desirable to women and have your pick or have more of a pick, then your status will be key to that. Here in Taiwan, it's absolutely the same. You know, this is one of the reasons the work culture is so driven, is because one's position at work, most of one's social status derives from one's job and from one's income and from one's assets, not from being a nice guy or being charming or being handsome. You know, better to be an ugly guy who owns 5 factories than to be the handsome guy working in the factory. As the there's an internet meme that kind of covers this very well, which says, if I had a dollar for every woman who doesn't find me attractive, they would find me attractive.
There you go.
So there you can see that actually he's not using a biological argument for why men seek status. He's actually using a constructionist argument. He's saying that because of the kinds of societies we live in and because of what women generally want, that's why men feel that if they can't get those things, they will fail to realize, you know, their own personal ambitions. So that's one reason why, you know, I've even seen it in the classroom here. One time I was trying to teach this young girl English. I think she was 10 years old. And she was just resolute that she wasn't interested. And I said, you know, come on, why don't you want to learn it? You know, if you want to have a good life, have a good job later, you need to be able to speak English in Taiwan. You can't just speak Chinese. And she said to me, 10 years old, she said, teacher, I'm beautiful. I will have a rich husband.
She was 10 years old. My God.
She's 10 years old. And there you hear it. But as they say, don't they? I'm out of the mouth of babes.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
So I did not find the stuff in his memo particularly objectionable, although I would take issue with the idea that women are generally more neurotic than men. I think he's probably on skating on thin ice there. But many of the other parts about the fact that every time there's some difference in performance between men and women in the workplace, that this diversity mantra, this equality mantra, sees only that there must be some injustice at the heart of it, and then creates these programs to try and bridge the gap. What he's saying is maybe this difference in performance is actually rooted in biology, which we're no longer allowed to talk about. It's verboten. And that these programs, which seemingly strive to address the gap, this gap can't be addressed in that manner. And actually, in a way, it becomes unfair to the male employees, because the women and the people of color in the workplace are receiving all kinds of extra services and coaching and support that is not available to the white male workers at Google. So there again, you know, he says himself, when I write this, I'm just going to be dismissed as a whining white man. Well, that is true. 2, he says, I'm probably going to get fired. Well, that is a given.
Yeah.
And 3, I've noticed that in the very shrill, furious backlash articles against him, they all, every single one of the articles I've read, misrepresents his memo. You know, they present it as a straw man. You know, they don't really go into what he said. They're just furious. They're too furious to think clearly about what he's done, but they're just adamant, you know, that he must be destroyed.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you say about the... I mean, he's referring to biology, and obviously the way that's being demonised at the moment, you know, you mention anything from a biological standpoint, you're going to be generally called a bigot in some ways.
Yeah, for the moment, this kind of social constructionist argument, which I do have a lot of sympathy for in the soft version, but I don't have the sympathy for it when it's used to explain everything.
Mm.
You know, the idea that we can have a perfectly equal society, that there's generally absolutely no differences between men and women. This idea that there's no differences between men and women, to me, seems the absolute, you know, best example of social constructionism.
Well,
trying to rewrite reality.
Yeah,
you can sort of see it in the way that boys and girls are being pressured to kind of become one another, you know, so you end up without these gender differences.
Well, interesting.
Sorry.
That's all right. I was going to say that I come across this article, and I'm not even sure whether it's satirical or not. I don't know whether you had a look at it, but the headline goes... New Google technology auto-corrects users' thoughts. Now, when I read that, I did laugh, and I thought, right, this is satirical. But it goes on, which I just find, I'm going to read this, this will wrap up this little section here. But it says, at a special press conference held at the technology's giant sprawling campus Tuesday, Google engineers revealed exciting new technology that auto-corrects any errant thoughts its users are having, replacing them with positions approved by the company. Utilizing advanced retinal scan and proprietary telepathic scanning technology, the new automatic thought correction algorithm is now live for users of Google search engine, Android operating systems, Chrome OS, and the hundreds of other apps and services the company provides. It goes on to say, to give you an example, which is relevant at the moment. Let's say you start thinking that there are some kind of inherent biological differences between men and women. Immediately, the thought suggestion program in any nearby Google device, app or service will scrub the idea of inherent gender differences and replace them with the sure knowledge that there are at least 300 different genders in existence, and always has been.
Cute, yeah, that's sinister. A great idea. And actually, in a Philip K. Dick novel, that process would be seamless.
Yeah.
So you would not experience the errant thought. You would only actually experience the corrected thought. It wouldn't have a chance to actually pass through your mind. So it would be like one of those, you know, Total Recall kind of scenarios. If they could do it, they would do it.
Yeah.
If they can do it now, then they probably are doing it now.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a satire that's on the verge of becoming reality. Actually, Facebook has got all this kind of brain scanning technology that they're trying to develop, you know, so it's probably not that far away.
So we've just highlighted that, you know, what various big internet companies are suggesting that they've got planned for us little sheep. Now, the Children's Commissioner, Anne Longfield, I believe her name is, she's been making some headlines recently. She has called this particular concept digital five a day. Now, we're familiar with the five a day vegetables.
I wasn't really familiar with that.
Well, don't you...
I thought it was, I don't know. I've not been in England for a long time, so I thought it was fruit and vegetables. Is it just vegetables? I don't know.
I occasionally have a vegetable. Usually it's meat.
I don't believe Rochdale that people generally eat fruit, do they? It's rare to sight an orange.
That'd be more
in Rochdale.
Like five kebabs a day.
Unless there's fruit inside. Well, cider is probably as close as most people get to their fruit intake.
So did you catch any of what she was going on about this, Anne Longfield? Did you hear any of what she was saying?
Are you trying to wind me up with that question? Because you know I watch Sky News on the 24-hour feed. And honestly, that day, it should have just been called Anne Longfield Day on Sky News. Because anyone listening that watched Sky News on that particular day will know exactly what I'm talking about. I think she read the weather. She did the sport. She did the entertainment news. She told you your stars.
Yeah.
She was everywhere. And not with a very interesting message, actually. Now, the Children's Commissioner, I was kind of, I went to look on their website. I thought their website would look something like Sesame Street or something, you know, I thought it'd be child friendly. Actually, it's a very boring website. And they do a lot of kind of valuable work about, you know, the policy kind of implications on children, policy impacts on children. But this one, I feel, is absolutely, oh, the kids are on holiday. You know, we've got to just put ourselves out there. We've got to find a bit of nonsense that people can grab onto. Okay, digital five a day. And even the idea is not their idea. They do acknowledge on their website that they borrowed it off the NHS.
Well, there you go. Well, let's have a listen to what she says.
Here's the Children's Commissioner for England, Anne Longfield. She joins us now from Ilkley in West Yorkshire. First of all, what is the answer to this? How can parents control their children's use of social media?
Well, good morning. Well, I think this is, rather than parents controlling their use of children's social media, what I'm asking parents to do is to actually intervene, to talk with their children, to find a way through this that actually enables children to benefit from the great opportunities that the internet brings without falling into that trap that we know they feel, the pressure they feel to be online and the pressure they feel never to leave that go. Now, we're in the school holidays. We know that many children are feeling very stressed by that constant kind of draw of being online. And we know too that parents are struggling to work out quite how they do that. So what we're putting forward today is the idea of a digital five a day. It will actually help get a healthy diet of online time and enable children and their parents to work out how they do this.
So what exactly do you mean by a digital five a day?
Well, we all know what five a day means in terms of what we eat, in terms of our food. It means a range of things. It means healthy things. It means not indulging too much in the things which are less healthy for us. And it's the same with the digital world. So if it's just a constant YouTube video or constant social media that is stressing children and which is raising anxiety, then we want children and parents to be able to notice that and actually limit the time that they spend on that. But importantly, this isn't just about telling children what to do. We know that they're the kids who actually will know most about their digital lives. It's about informing them so they can manage their time online better.
So can you give us some specific examples then of what these five a day would entail?
Well, for instance, one of those is about getting connected and getting involved and being creative. So actually, there's all sorts of creative things that you can do online, filmmaking, arts and crafts and the like. But actually, you need to look those out and take part in them. And, you know, real opportunity that you'd never have otherwise. So use that creative time online, but also be mindful. Often people on social media, adults and children, will make comments about others, will make comments about film, will put things online without really understanding the impact that will have on others. So part of being a good digital citizen is actually about being mindful to others too.
Do you know what? When you listen to that, obviously, while I was editing it, I was listening to it quite a few times, and she is incapable of speaking clearly, it seems.
I was just thinking the same thing as we listened to that, is that I don't mean to be harsh, but...
No, be harsh.
You do feel like interjecting there and just saying, excuse me, you have... One, you either have no idea what you're talking about, or two, what you're talking about makes no sense whatsoever. So it's at the level... It's the presentation layer or the content layer or both, but it makes literally no sense. in terms of the metaphor, you know, the food metaphor, she actually says something like, just like you wouldn't let your children eat 5 cheeseburgers a day, you don't let them use YouTube for 5 hours. You know, it's like this. Now, in terms of metaphor, I read this very good book, actually, about metaphor called Metaphors We Live By. Now, the idea is that you use a domain that you're more familiar with, here, food, eating, to structure another domain that is not necessarily so well known. So the reason she's grasping the food metaphor is because we all understand, like, you can't eat a McDonald's every day, 3 times a day. So she's using this to try and roll it over into this other domain. But actually, it's not really a very successful transfer in my eyes. And as children's commissioner, she's going to talk about connectivity, art projects, making a film, these things. Yeah, why doesn't she just say, don't do it online? Yeah. Why doesn't she just say, turn off your phone? That would be the actual message. That would be the actual message. Instead, it's like saying, you're going to eat a cheeseburger, but take the cheese out. Or you're going to eat the apple pie, only eat half. You know, that's not really a healthy option. It's slightly less unhealthy, but it's not healthy. It's like these people that will tell you that, you know, they'll tell you that there's like a slightly more healthy chocolate bar now. But there's no such thing as a healthy chocolate bar, is there? It'd be like saying there's slightly healthier heroin for you to inject because it's not so impure. It doesn't compute. It's still always be a chocolate bar will always be worse, no matter how less unhealthy it is, than eating an apple. It's like this idea of cleaner cars. There will never be a car as clean as not having a car. You know, it's a fantasy. This philosopher Zizek, you know, the famous Slovenian philosopher, he says that our modern condition now is typified by this kind of view, you know, where people want kind of, you know, cakes without sugar, you know, beer without alcohol. You want it, but you want the thing that's harmful in it removed somehow. You know, you want it kind of, you want it and you don't want it. And this, to me, this digital 5 a day just sounds like nonsense, doesn't it? It's like, if you start to structure it using the actual metaphor in a more kind of granular way, then you'd get something like, we were laughing about it, weren't we? You'd get something like virtual carrots.
You say
peaches in digital cream. You know.
Well, okay. So where we've just covered the stuff with the Google and the Facebooks and the YouTubes, which are basically algorithm due to near death, where basically you're just going to get force-fed loads of basically poor quality food, if we're going to use the same analogy as...
We prefer not to. Let her have her way.
Yeah. Well, so then when you pointed out to me about the ex-GCHQ saying that kids need to spend more time on the internet, that did come across as a little bit sinister. Explain about that.
It was brilliant, wasn't it? It reminded me a little of that kind of scenario where, you know, the mum, like Andrea Longfield, is like the mum in the family, and she's one of these kind of health Nazis. So she's taking you out to the restaurant, like a hotel buffet, and she's sitting in her chair talking to the little children and basically preaching the gospel of healthy eating. So she's talking about salad. Maybe you can't even have any croutons or bacon, but she's talking salad, she's talking fruit, she's saying that you're going to go to the sports center afterwards and run around for an hour. She's saying all of these things, and then over in the rocking chair is sat the ex-head of GCHQ with a cigar in his mouth and a glass of whiskey, and he's the indulgent grandfather figure. And what he's saying is, kids, load up your plates. Ice cream, chocolate, cheeseburgers, pizza, cake, M&Ms. Rub your face in it if you have to, but get it down you. Go. And all the kids are just running off crazy and just jumping in the ice cream tubs and sticking their head straight in the gatto. And his argument here is, yes, mum, it's poor parenting, but it could just save the country. Because his point is, you need kids to spend their entire lives online so they can grow up to be the next kind of Edward Snowden without the traitorous.
Yeah, without
part.
Actually releasing anything, without actually yeah. having any facts or
yeah,
truth.
Yeah, they'll be like the good Snowden, the one you never hear about.
Yeah.
So he says, don't worry. He says, all that time that they're spending online, don't try and pull them away from it, because like little engineers, they're exploring the digital domain. And if you actually look on the research, when he says they're exploring the digital domain, yeah, actually, the places they're exploring seem to be like ex-hamster, tube kitty, Pornhub, and the rest of it, because there's an enormous amount of children now getting expelled from school for because they've got this hardcore porn addiction they've developed through their smartphones. But Hannigan doesn't mind that, actually. He just says, like I say, fill your bowl, fill your plate, get on with it, break it, work out how it works, and one day you'll be there at the donut in Cheltenham, saving the country with your cyber skills. And yeah, he's been kind of blasted afterwards by all these children's commissioners supporters, but he's kind of unrepentant because he's done his patriotic duty in the Telegraph.
Yeah, oh, it's crazy stuff when I come across that. Right, so we've got 15 minutes, Jay. I don't think we're going to get everything in, so let's do a bit of jumping about. What one would you like to do? Loon Watch, the transgendered agenda, or the...
I would rather look at the politically correct charities and okay, just then. Finish off with this. The first one, should we do the Barnardo's one?
Kind of.
We'll spend just a few minutes on one, but this is extraordinary.
Gunning.
Truly extraordinary. Barnardo's are running a campaign against FGM. Now, for anyone who doesn't know, it's nothing to do with genetically modified crops. This is genetically mutilated females.
Yeah.
So this is a practice where, and I don't think it, well, I didn't believe it was politically incorrect to say this. It's a little like when you talk about guide dogs without talking about blind people.
Yeah.
So exactly. Here, FGM is wholly confined to the African and Middle Eastern communities in the UK. There are no white people practicing FGM. It is an implanted practice from cultures that have moved to the UK and have kept their, in quotes, traditions. So Barnardo's wishes to raise awareness of FGM. So they ran this ad, and the ad features a white girl.
Which goes against kind of the, you know, there's been a lot of this on the news actually over the recent months. And I missed the white girl ad from Barnardo's. I would have thought Barnardo's, actually, considering how long they've been around, would have known better about that. Yeah, I mean, it's given it a completely different context, isn't it? But if they're, I mean, you could look at it from the point of view, the reason they used the white girl was to bring more attention to people who are not necessarily associated with the culture where it resides.
I can't go along with that idea because it just misrepresents it.
Yeah, it does that. Yeah, yeah.
If you opened a pizza restaurant, you wouldn't put a picture of, you know, Mexican food on your ad. And then when people came to the restaurant, you say, well, we put Mexican food on the ad, but actually it's a pizza restaurant. You know,
well, if you did that, you'd be done for cultural appropriation, probably.
Yeah, probably. Oh, well, there's been a whole thing, hasn't there, about how white people are not allowed to teach yoga anymore. White people are not allowed to meditate anymore. Yes, that's from the East.
Lunacy.
Yeah. So here, I would say, no, there's actually, it can only be construed as having been undertaken as an exercise in political correctness, which is that they did not wish to offend Muslim and African communities who actually are the ones that have this problem. I would even go further personally. I would suggest that they shouldn't even use English as the language for the ad. They should use the indigenous languages of those communities so that white people who have nothing to do with this problem don't have to even bother registering it. It should just be, I don't know what languages they speak, but it should just be in Pashto or Farsi or Urdu.
Yeah, but you see, maybe this is
Swahili, right. Whichever one. Because, as I say, it's wholly a problem that has been brought to the UK by members of these cultures. And for Barnardo's to run the white girl, you know, completely misrepresent it. They're trying to change reality, and at the same time, they're trying to avoid reality. We're back to the Zizek thing, aren't we? You know, they want to raise awareness while also misrepresenting the problem itself. They got criticized. One of the comments said on their Twitter feed, it said, well, why don't you just use a boy in the ad?
Yeah.
So make as much sense.
Yeah, exactly.
So they have apologized, actually. So that was the Bernardo story, but that was just one more example of this kind of crazy situation in the UK. Do you want to say any more, or do you want to turn our attention to the second one?
No, well, let's go to Thou Shalt Show Pride. National Trust, U-turn on forcing volunteers to wear gay pride badges after membership exodus.
Now, I thought the National Trust, its mission was kind of clear. It's a little like English Heritage, isn't it? They look after all kinds of buildings and parks all around the British Isles. And you go and visit it, and it's always, you know, some frightfully nice middle-aged lady. I did a few jobs with the National Trust. I did one at this place called Killerton House, which I don't know if you're aware of. It's just outside Exeter. And they were, you know, that kind of jam-making Women's Institute type ladies, you know, just polite to a fault. But no, because the National Trust now has decided that they can't just do their job. They've got all kinds of values now too. And their values are going to be your values. And if your values aren't their values, well, then they don't value you. And you can either sling your hook, or you could be hidden from the public. You can be secreted away inside the basement of a stately home until you change your ways. So would you like to say just what this issue was?
Right, okay. So what I thought was funny, there's a couple of things in this that made me chuckle, actually. So is it Annabelle Smith, who is the head of volunteering and participation development? She has been on record saying that, relating specifically to the Prejudice and Pride programme, we do recognise that some volunteers may have conflicting personal opinions. And you'd read that and you think, yeah, well, she seems understanding. However, it goes on. Whilst volunteering for the National Trust, we do request and expect individuals to uphold the values of the organisation. I would assume that would include even the ones that you may have some personal conflicts with.
Well, I think we should lock her in a box with Andrea Longfield. Fire her off into space. And they can just sort it out. So we didn't actually describe what happened. But what happened was there's this, she said here there's this Prejudice and Pride program. Yeah. Now, as part of this, the National Trust wanted all of its volunteers to wear these lanyards of gay pride. So these kind of rainbow lanyards.
Yeah.
And they didn't expect anyone to object, clearly. They were just ordering you to show pride. Now, if you wish to show your solidarity, your affinity, your support for your gay brothers and sisters, or your 67 genders, however many there are now,
85.
You would think that the choice would be made on a personal basis. Not that you roll into work and the little manager pops out and says, right, put these on, chaps. Today you're all having gay pride. No, that's not how it works. So as you pointed out, we do see there the kind of example of another Orwellian thing, which is doublethink, where someone believes, one, that they recognize conflicting personal opinions, but in the next sentence completely offers you the alternative view, which is your job is to uphold our values. Now, I did say to you, for example, that these values are okay when they work in a negative way. We understand it in this way, don't we, when they work in a negative way. So it's what you don't do. So when a black person comes to the National Trust, to a stately home, you know, then you treat them just like anyone else. You know, that's what non-discrimination is about. When a gay couple come, you treat them the same as you treat everybody else. That's what we understand. It's a negative. You don't treat people differently.
Yeah.
But this one is forcing people to celebrate or to approve of a particular identity.
Well, and
what are they going to have next? They're going to have pro-black program where you have to make a black power salute when a black person rolls up at Ragley Hall.
Yeah, well, this is what it is that you are being coerced into having a very narrow field of vision, along with, you know, if you look at it from the kind of the post-fact world, where if people tell you complete nonsense, if you disagree with nonsense, you're now being ostracized out of society. You're being told that, you know, you're ignorant or you're, you know, bigot, racist, homophobic, transphobic, whatever it may be. Even if you were to point out basic fundamental, your own rights, you're allowed to have your own opinions. This is taking that completely away. It's worrying on a number of levels, actually, on a social level, because how long is it going to be before people end up being arrested for not being... I mean, you're already in a situation where you can lose a job.
Absolutely. And there's the disconnect here, which, as you said, from the people implementing these things, the Annabelle Smiths of the world, they don't see the disconnect. To these people, if you object to the coercion, you're homophobic because you won't support gay pride. Whereas actually, myself, I'd support that gay pride, no problem. Gay people deserve to be treated just the same as everyone else. But I object to the coercion. I object to someone telling me what I've got to wear, what I've got to think, basically, what I've got to feel, what I have to do. And if I don't do what they want me to, then I'm going to suffer some kind of sanction for this. No, I object to that 100%. Personally, I don't believe that it's right to coerce people, whether it's for these supposedly good ends or bad ends. I'm against coercion, full stop. Just as in the same way on the censorship question, I'm against censorship, full stop. I'm not for censorship when it's someone I don't like, because you can't take you can't find a middle ground here. If you approve of censorship, then one day people that you approve of get censored. If you approve of coercion, then one day, you know, you're being coerced into something that you're not so happy about. So I think you have to just object to them in principle, as you point out there, and just say, no, it's wrong. But as you're pointing out, when you do say no,
that's when the trouble
starts. Take a stand, you're the one. It's like Monty Python style, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're the one that the 100-ton weight falls on instantly.
Yeah, yeah. It's everything's being inverted.
It is, and maybe people can join us next time for Inside Track 28, where we'll kind of try and turn the world back the right the way up. Turn the world. I can't even say it.
Easy for you to say, mate.
I think Google was trying to edit my thoughts there.
Yeah. Or you've caught.
Yeah. Well,
you got them
in an upside down world. We will be trying to turn it back the right way up for you, but until then, we'll just have to leave you with a song.
Okay.
Best we can do, I believe, is another Donovan number.
Yeah.
But thank you to everyone who's listened, and we'll join us again next week.
Yeah, thank you, Joe, as always, and thank you everyone as well for listening. Much appreciated. We'll be here again next Thursday at 4 o'clock, and now we're live on air. Lovely to spend the afternoon with you, everyone, and enjoy. This would be for Jay, actually, because obviously with the jaundice thing and looking remote, you know, remarkably yellow. This can be for you, Jay.
I'm just mad about saffron. Saffron's mad about me. I'm just mad about saffron. She's just mad about me.